And, you know, they're being led by a couple of things, Nikki. They're being led by just that whole thing about there's more than one kind of olive. Mm-hmm. You know, when people understand that there's more than one kind of grape, and then chocolate tastings and beer tastings and cheese tastings, olive oil tastings aren't that far removed. And I'd say that was probably the primary driver. And secondarily, it's the health benefits that we're learning about. I hope we could talk about both because, you know, for me, I like to lead with the aspect of pleasure. Of course, being healthy is a good part of that.
So if you're a regular listener to Sip with Nikki, I just want to give you a shout out and say hello and I see you. And thank you so much for spending time with me each week. If you have left a review in Apple or Spotify, a rating, a thumbs up on YouTube, I just want to say a huge thank you. And if you're new to Sip with Nikki, hi, I'm Nikki, and I'm so happy that you're here. This week, we are going to be doing an olive oil 101. So a couple of years ago, I was introduced to Liz Tagami, who is a fascinating individual. She lives just a couple hours north of me, and she has over 35 years of experience working in product development and retail for brands we all know and love, like Williams-Sonoma, Cost Plus World Market, Harry & David. She even has a background developing curriculum for cooking schools. But about 16 years ago, she stepped away from all of that and started her own business specializing in olive oil. She was first an international broker in olive oil and then was a consultant. And now she is a partner with her husband and a boutique olive oil company called Lucero Olive Oil, which they have also sort of rebranded and is part of the American Olive Farmer. AmericanOliveFarmer.com is their website. I was fortunate enough to meet her when I was investigating and still thinking about the potential of making my own olive oil to supplement our Solovato wine label that Michael and I have. And I just was really struck by her not only knowledge and wisdom of olive oil, but her passion, especially now that she is the one making these beautiful oils. So she's going to break down all of the questions and the myths and the confusion that people have around what makes extra virgin olive oil extra virgin, and is that really better? The hot topic, of course, which is the health benefits of olive oil, and also what drives price differences when you see really large, you know, containers of oil in the big box store, you know, versus a boutique 500 ml bottle. Like, what is the difference? She guides me through the proper way to actually taste olive oil with special tasting glasses. And we even talk about the perfect pairing. So I think you'll find it really interesting and helpful, especially if you're like me and you're someone that loves olive oil, but maybe don't know a whole lot about it. And there was so much information to share that she and I spent a good amount of time together on our recording. So I've split it into part one and part two. So this week, you're in for your 101, your great introduction. And next week, we'll build upon it with olive oil 102. Here we go with Liz Tagami. Cheers, my friend. Here's to your first podcast. I cannot believe this is your first time on a podcast. How is this even possible?
I know, right? It's been time. And it's the perfect person to do this with.
Well, thank you.
And should we take a sip here?
Yes, we should.
We raised our glasses.
A little Solovato. Okay. Cheers.
My mouth is singing.
I can't say anything about it because I made it. So I have to be quiet and let you say whatever you're going to say. And that can be now or later.
Oh, can I just say juicy?
That's a great word.
And my socks, if I had socks on, they'd be rolling up and down. I love this wine. Before we joined the session formally, on the first pour, I set the glass down, and we do something in olive oil tasting when we're talking about aroma. And it's not universal. I learned this from a taster in Spain. He said, you know, if you can detect the aroma at arm's length, that's a 10. That's 10 fruity. If you have to stick your nose all the way in the glass, then, you know, that's really like 0 or 1. And I thought that physical description was really helpful because you're there and you're on a taste panel and you're calibrating and you're, you know, you agree that, okay, this we're tasting a 3 or we're tasting a 5. But when he said that, the first time I picked up a glass and I had a 10 and I was like, oh, wow, this is a really grassy, green, amazing oil. And I was like, I was just starting to lift it to my face. Nikki's, if for those of you who have not yet tasted this or experienced this wine, this is a 10 fruity for me, just, you know, coming right out of the bottle. And the flavor does not disappoint.
Well, thank you. That's a new thought for me about smelling from arm's length. I'm going to use that. And even though I have notoriously short arms, I say that I have T-Rex arms. You know, arm's length is still a generally good measurement. So enough about me. We're here to learn about you, my friend. So first and foremost, thank you for being here. I know that you're busy. I know that you have a lot going on and farming and in business and in speaking and all the things that you do. So I'm just so excited for our listeners to A, get to know you, but B, they have a lot of questions about olive oil. I told you I put out a call for listener questions.
Listener questions.
And the list is long. So people are really curious about this. So before we jump in and start debunking and teaching people the correct and accurate information about olive oil, how did you get into this world? How did this come to be?
Gosh, I'll try to keep it as the short version. And that just to say, you know, I'm a Californian. I'm a sixth generation Californian. So we grew up with the bounty around us. And that said, my mom was a product of the convenience era. So she wasn't a scratch cook. My husband's mom is a generation older. She was a European immigrant. So it was a completely different way of cooking. And my first olive oil experience that I can recall was the Time Life cookbook series from the 70s, maybe. It was a sleeve that had a hardbound book in it with beautiful pictures and stories and a little spiral bound with recipes for the kitchen. And we had food of Italy, China, India, and France. And I was in high school. So my boyfriend at the time, and now my husband, and I would go through these and we would like read the cookbooks and do things.
Did you marry your high school sweetheart?
I did. Oh, we've been together since 1976. Yes.
Oh, yes. That's amazing. I love it. All right. Continue.
So, and the recipe called for 2 tablespoons of olive oil. And so, you know, and we were cooking out of his mom's kitchen. So it's like, oh, there isn't any olive oil here. Let's go to Ratto's in downtown Oakland. It's the old Italian deli that was, I think, from 1860s or something. Old wooden floors. And we bought a little 250 ml bottle of olive oil in clear glass. And we dutifully measured it, carefully measured out the 2 tablespoons as if we were doing, you know, baking powder in a baking recipe or something, you know, it was because we were trying to be exact to what Time Life told us. And it had to be olive oil. And I'm sure it went into the cupboard and, you know, it came out if you needed it again for a recipe. It wasn't like that's what was used every day. Later on, I was in college. I worked for a kitchenware shop in Oakland. Larger than life personality, Bill Hughes ran John A. Brown Kitchenware, which was a wonderful store at a time when independent kitchen shops were abundant. And John A. Brown was where people in the East Bay shopped. Mm-hmm. Bruce, Adele's taught there, Barbara Tropp taught there, Joyce Goldstein came to us and special ordered her pasta maker for Square One when she opened the restaurant back in the day. So we were there. I was exposed to a lot of Bay Area personalities. And this is the era when Beowulf and Chez Panisse were in healthy competition.
Alice Waters.
And
you were in college at that time in the Bay Area?
I was in college. Well, it started as a music performance major, but it was in a liberal arts college that didn't really have music performance.
You guys can't see me, so but my jaw is wide open. I didn't know this about you, music performance. Instrumental, vocal, tell me more.
Yeah, I was a flute player, very serious flute player, and I decided to drop out of school and go to the conservatory as a music performance major. And that summer, I thought, what am I doing? All of the support I have at college, because I went to Mills College on scholarship and student loans and working 3 jobs. So I told the conservatory I changed my mind and Mills take me back. And I switched to modern European history.
Oh, that's a switch. Okay.
It is, but it, you know, I think college is not trade school. It's a way to learn to think critically. And I excelled in those sorts of things, making arguments and forming a antithesis, you know, seeing something mm-hmm. and creating a new thesis. Mm-hmm. So I loved it. And then when I stopped, what was I going to do? I'd already been in retail since I was 15. So Bill brought in something called Kimberly Olive Oil, which was a California producer. And they were known for their wine vinegars. They had a red wine vinegar, a white wine vinegar in little splits with a sloped shoulder. Mm-hmm. Very cute. And then they had an olive oil that matched it. Mm-hmm. And so we had those on the shelf. And I was like, okay, that's very sweet. I didn't buy that stuff. I mean, it was, you know, making whatever it was, $3 an hour. So, you know, it was just, that was just very nice. But in 1985, when I was at Williams Sonoma, I was the catalog manager. The buyer came to me and he says, I want to put Kimberly Olive Oil on the back cover of the July 1985 Williams Sonoma catalog. Could you call them and ask them what kind of olives they use in their olive oil? And this is where I'm going to confess my ignorance. Even though I am a Californian and I had been in the food industry at that point for 5 years, I didn't say anything to the buyer at the time, but it was like, what type of olive? You mean there's more than one?
Round from a tree?
Yeah, right? Like, well, I know. There's green and black, right? Mm, and some of them green have pimentos.
Yeah.
So they came back and said, these are Mission olives. And the guy nodded sagely and says, okay, true California variety. Mission olive is the only native variety. It's olives self-hybridized. And so the story is that starting Argentina, Peru, Chile, you know, all the way up to California, when the Jesuits came as missionaries and brought grape cuttings and slips for olive trees and planted them for themselves, olive trees, like apples, will self-hybridize, and they became something new. We've taken cuttings of Mission olives have been taken back to Spain to check their massive database for DNA, and they have no match. So it is a uniquely
own thing.
California,
hybridized
its own thing.
In California.
California. And so that was really cool. Yeah. And as it turned out, that the buyer was from Lindsay, California, which was where the home of Lindsay olives, the canned uh-huh. olives, right? Uh-huh. And that kind of stayed with me. Then while I was at Williams-Sonoma, we had a chance to start buying olive oil on a regular basis. So I always had 750 ml on the counter. My husband's was at the time a professional cook. So we always had olive oil. And we did a little tasting bar at the Williams-Sonoma flagship, that which is kind of a big thing for us in the early 90s. It wasn't until I left corporate in 2008 that I was walking through a San Francisco fancy food show. And when you are under pressure as a corporate buyer or divisional manager or vice president, and I was all of those things, you don't really get a chance to take a lot of education classes and do things and, you know, industry events that are kind of go deeper because you've got the corporate demands. Mm-hmm. And I stopped by the booth for the California Olive Oil Council and started asking some questions. And the director was great. She said, you know, you pay me, and I think it was like, write a check for $50 and you can come to our annual meeting in Sonoma. It's like, okay, Nikki, it kicked off an epiphany is the best word I could think for me. Because in 2008, the Olive Center at UC Davis was established, a new laboratory in Northern California devoted only to assessing olive oils was established, and a big change in terms of how we started to learn and talk about olives. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the journey, you know, yes, at Ratto's Deli in 1977, I was there and we bought, you know, a little bit of olive oil. But it was at that meeting that my eyes were opened about the importance of olive oil to the industry and to home cooks. Growing up in the Bay Area, I was 45 minutes away from the wine country. Mm-hmm. I missed that whole thing about the judgment of Paris and everything because I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Right. Napa was the schoolyard taunt. And, you know, coming from out of state, you might not know this, but that's where the state mental institution was, mental hospital in Napa. So on the playground, if you wanted to insult somebody, you'd say your mama in Napa.
Stop. I've never heard that.
Your mama in Napa. It was not a,
Let
it was not a,
out. I never
it was not
heard
a,
that.
Yeah. So later in the 80s, when Napa, you know, you'd go to Trevina and you'd go to St. Helena, it was a completely different vibe. But, you know, it was like, oh, if only I knew and had money and bought property in 1967 or something, you know?
Yeah.
But olive oil was right there at that meeting. It's like, look at all the money. It is not a thirsty crop. Almonds, prunes, you know, all these stone fruits take so much water, double the water that olives take, and the consumption rates. So I'll go back to that 250 ml. That, by chance, is about the per capita consumption in the U.S. at that time.
250 mils of olive oil, which is like
a third of a
bottle. You knew that's how I was going to measure in 750.
Well, that's how I think it. Okay. I think in 750s.
Okay.
People go, oh, how many liters? I say, well, it's a half
bottle of wine is our benchmark in our world for sure. So per year.
Because we talk in milliliters. Per year and per capita and average. So there were some families that probably had a lot, but you know, at probably the household penetration rate was, you know, 25 or 30% of households even had olive oil.
And what year was that?
That was mid-70s.
Okay.
Mid-70s. And the last measure I saw was, if we look at like 2022, 23, because the data doesn't always catch up to us, it looks like a liter and a half, you know? So it was from 250 to 100 to 1500 milliliters, which is great.
This is U.S.
This is U.S. Good, U.S. consumers.
Good job, America.
More people. And, you know, they're being led by a couple of things, Nikki. They're being led by just that whole thing about there's more than one kind of olive. Mm-hmm. You know, when people understand that there's more than one kind of grape, and then chocolate tastings and beer tastings and cheese tastings, olive oil tastings aren't that far removed. And I'd say that was probably the primary driver. And secondarily, it's the health benefits that we're learning about. I hope we could talk about both because, you know, for me, I like to lead with the aspect of pleasure. Of course, being healthy is a good part of that.
But I would like to, if we can, start with kind of a good foundation for our listeners and then build upon it. When we get a question from Dominic in New Jersey, who wants to know something like, what is the difference between extra virgin olive oil, EVOO, and quote, regular? So can we get into, I know this could be a whole podcast episode, but if we could define and summarize the importance and the definition of EVOO.
Right. Well, so olive oil grading is very specific, both with chemistry and with sensory aspects, organoleptic, if you will. I'd say that the easiest way to approach it is binary. If an olive oil is made solely by mechanical means, and that's the exact nomenclature, solely by mechanical means, it's called virgin.
Mm.
If it, and I didn't even use the word extra, it's just virgin at that point. If something is used to chemically extract the oil, like in the seed oil industry, it's typical to use heat, pressure, and hexane, or sometimes benzene, to extract, because those are more difficult. I mean, think of those little seeds, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the olive oil industry, if there are really horrible defects, so let's say there are some countries where there are a lot more trees than there are mills, and some of these trees are very inaccessible. They're on hillsides and things like that, and yet there's always a shortage of oil. You need to be able to get to them. So the least expensive, the easiest way to get an olive harvested is by gravity. You let the fruit get so ripe that it falls from the tree. And at that point, it's already beginning to ferment. And when it's on the ground, it quickly becomes a form of compost. You have anaerobic fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a defect called fustiness. And what they'll do is allow that, the first of all, maximum oil. They'll sweep that up, rocks, cow dung, bad olives and all, put it through the mill and crush it, but they have to deodorize it. And that becomes the end product is pure olive oil.
Okay.
So when you see something called pure olive oil, what it is, it's just refined. And it's the aside with the, even if it's completely sterile at the beginning, the fact is that they are overripe and fermented, and that's going to affect the aroma and the flavor.
To me, that word pure in that context, how you just described it then is a bit misleading. No?
Well, it's unfortunately a marketing term. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, oh, I only eat pure olive oil. Well, it's like that's actually by definition, it means it's been refined.
Okay.
So safflower, corn oil, peanut oil, avocado oil, all of those are refined oils. They have, because of the nature of the oil itself, they have to go through a refining process. Now, back to Dominic's question specifically about extra virgin. Remember, I mentioned there's something called virgin.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an oil solely by mechanical means, just that nice family goes out, they crush the olives, and it's got some defect. Oh, you know, some bad olives got in it, and I've got some fustiness. It becomes virgin.
Mm-hmm.
There is a slight defect. Or if there is some imbalance or something else. So it's like, if you can't meet the chemical standard or the sensory standard, it's just virgin. And a very high percentage of the world population for millennia have enjoyed virgin olive oil.
Okay.
That is what it is. I would say extra virgin really is a post-World War II concept that comes from the industrialization of how we can extract oils in the modern era. The idea of extra virgin is that not only does it have no defects, but it has a certain level of aroma and a chemistry. This idea that you've made the standard, you are extra virgin, this will indicate to me that it's going to be a pleasant culinary experience and more healthful than something that's already starting to ferment.
Okay.
How you define extra virgin in terms of chemistry varies depending if you're talking to the USDA, the International Olive Council in Madrid, or the Olive Oil Commission of California. The Australian Olive Association, have an even higher standard than Madrid. Madrid, if you look at some journalists who talk about the definition of extra virgin, they go, oh, it has to have 1% free fatty acid or less. Well, that was a standard from decades ago. Madrid changed that to 0.8. Well, the USDA says 0.5. California says 0.3.
Well, no wonder,
and in fact,
consumers are confused. There's no
and
one
many of
standard.
Us, there's no one standard. And many of us in California, when we have a new oil and we have it tested, it's 0.1, 0.13. It's really hard if you've got good quality fruit and no delay to the mill. It's really hard to make a bad
that,
oil.
Like 0.1, that measurement. Tell me again. What is that measuring?
That's measuring free fatty acid, which in chemistry is this idea that oxidation is when the profile starts to break down and you start to indicate that.
Okay.
Let me just say as an aside that we now have measures way beyond free fatty acid. We have measures that can look at things in a much more sophisticated way. So, you know, now that we have these measures and we can use them to help ourselves to be better producers, there is something that's really important in all of this. And that is when people say, what's the best olive oil?
Yeah.
It's the one that you love. If somebody tells me that their grandmother... If their grandmother in Greece gives them 5 liters from their family and they take it and they keep it under the sink and they use it all year long, and if that happens to be fusty or have olive fly or by the end of the 12 months become rancid before the next harvest, who am I to say that that's a bad oil?
Sure.
That's what they love.
Sure.
And I'll tell you this. In North Africa and in the south of France, there is something called black olive oil, which is just as expensive as extra virgin. And that's olives that have been allowed to ferment. So that would technically be a defect mm-hmm. in the world of extra virgin. Mm-hmm. And what does a fermented olive taste like? Well, it tastes like canned olives. It tastes briny.
Mm.
It tastes like it's reminiscent of cheese or salami.
Which is probably preferred and or maybe nostalgic for some people. Right? Like childhood.
It's desired. Mm. It's desired. So again, in matters of taste, there's no dispute. But that same token,
sure.
you know, you have a very fresh olive oil. It's very clean in the mouth. There's no defects. It's just to get the fruit. And then you're going to do something that is very complex and maybe a little bit muddy. And, you know, maybe you'd call it barnyard if it were something.
Yeah.
And so I don't have virgin oils. I don't have black olive oils. But I appreciate, understand, and respect people who make them and love them mm-hmm. or are given them as gifts from their families, because that's part of our culture.
Yeah.
You know, people have had olive oil like that forever. So I hope that, Dominic, that answers your question.
Yeah.
I'd like to say one last thing, and I know I'm on a soapbox here, but if you are, your doctor tells you, your cardiologist, that you need extra virgin olive oil to lower your inflammation, and you're paying for an extra virgin and it's defective, if it is rancid or fermented, then you need to get your money back because you're not getting what you paid for. That's our beef, I think, in the industry, is mislabeling. If it's virgin, it's virgin. If it's black, it's black. If it's pure, it's pure. That's fine. There's plenty of room. you know, for any kind of oil. But if you're paying for extra virgin, it better be giving you, it better have all the right octane.
How do you know? I mean, rancid,
how do you know?
Most people would be able to experience the aroma or the flavor of rancid and say, this is not quite right. It's not fresh. It's not clean. But I mean, how do you know that you need to get your money back?
Well, I'll challenge you there, Nikki, because UC Davis did a study where they asked consumers which olive oil they liked. And of course, time has passed. But those consumers, the majority of them said they preferred the rancid oil.
Because it's what they're familiar with. Because I think most people are not storing it correctly and it's past its date. And to them, that's the baseline of what they think it tastes like. Yes?
Well, we were wringing our hands when we saw the results, all of us. I was in the sensory lab when they were talking about them. And somebody piped up from the back of the room and said, you asked the wrong question. The question isn't, which do you like? The question should have been, which olive oil is fresh?
Yeah.
And they would have been able to get that. And having run a tasting room and had little kids even who can tell you which one is fresh, it's different.
Yeah.
So let's go back to you're scratching your head now at home and you're wondering in the cupboard, is your olive oil fresh or not? I'll go back, and this is really helpful for Americans because it goes back to childhood. Do you remember the smell of Play-Doh?
Very much so. I can recall it instantly.
What's the aroma of crayons? Both of those are the smell of rancidity. They have high oil content and they're all rancid. So your olive oil should not smell like Play-Doh.
Which to me smells a little like paint. Is what I
something and
think
that
of.
There are ketones.
Yeah,
there's when you start looking
ketones.
At
ketones. Yeah, yeah.
And when we're talking about rancidity, it's important to remember that that's something that happens after the olive is grown and harvested and milled and bottled. There can be gorgeous gold medal, best of show oils that, if they're not stored the right way or if they're kept too long, will eventually be they'll smell like Play-Doh.
Okay, so I'm glad you brought this up because this is, let's answer Dana's question, which was, where should they be stored and how long are they fresh for?
Okay, well, this is an easy one for people who are listening to a wine podcast because our recommendation is cellar temperatures. Ambient temperatures in most homes are a little bit too warm.
Yep.
So certainly away from the stove. Heat, light, air are not good. So in wine, you probably talk about headspace.
Yeah.
You know, in the bottles you start drinking out. So if there's headspace in your bottle, if you have a bottle of olive oil and it's taking too long to consume, it may become oxidized. So, you know, even if it's got a 2-year shelf life, that's unopened.
Right.
Once you open it, you should consume it within probably 6 weeks, you know, I would say, or decant it into a smaller bottle.
I was just going to
say,
into a smaller bottle so you have less.
You can do that, or you could top it with some nitrogen if you have one of those little things that
like
you use for
like
wine.
Like you do for wine preservation, you can do that on your oil.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's somewhat limited because, you know, these gases work best under pressure. And, you know, so you can just put a little bit in.
Yeah.
It's better than nothing.
Sure.
You're displacing some of the air. So, yeah, I would say keep it cool. We like to say mid-60s is ideal.
Like wine. You mentioned about where you store it. What's interesting to me is if you go in most people's kitchens, especially if they like to cook, most people have a thing of olive oil next to the stove because that's convenient of where you're using it. But is it not the worst place to keep it because of the heat?
It is. Yeah. And, you know, we have ours within arm's reach of the burners as well. And you just got to try to keep it moved away when you get the burner on.
Yeah.
You know, so you got it within arm's reach. Do that. But then don't keep it there next to the hob, as they say.
Right.
You know, just keep it moved off. And we go through olive oil really fast. So we have no danger.
I'm sure you do not. Speaking of, okay, this kind of leads me to the health benefit question. Thinking about,
yes,
I consume a lot of olive oil. I'm guessing you, this being your world, probably even consume more. Are you a believer of the health benefits of a spoonful or a shot or sort of that internal, not just as a condiment approach?
Well, belief makes it sound like a religion.
Mine is my religion, so it's okay.
The science backs up that 2 to 4 tablespoons a day lead to a 30% reduction in degenerative diseases, enhanced cognitive function, a bunch of other things. There are over 200 micronutrients. And going back to the science, we know it's almost an embarrassment of riches what a good olive oil can do for you. It sounds like snake oil. Because you talk about diabetes and cholesterol and high blood pressure and dementia. But this is really important. The European culture, where you are enjoying leisurely meals with people you love with a glass of wine, has such wisdom embedded into it. The Mediterranean diet isn't just these quote unquote superfoods. The Mediterranean diet is about the pleasure of the table.
The time to enjoy.
The time to enjoy it. And Nikki, I might have shared this story with you before, but I'd like your listeners to know this as well. In 2010, I heard a lecture, a paper delivered by a Spanish doctor who specialized in olive oil and health. He was also a professional, a trained taster on a taste panel. And we were at a competition in Jerusalem. And he got up and he did his whole thing about olive oil and health. He'd been doing in vivo studies, real people studies with olive oil and health for 30 years. And so he spoke with great authority. And at the end, he looked around the room because, you know, there were people from Germany and America and Italy, as well as Spain and elsewhere. And I kind of think speaking from the Spanish, where they have these long meals and they walk around and they drink wine, he said, you know, this whole thing about eating a sandwich in the car, you know, or being by yourself and not enjoying it, it's not medicine. Don't take it like cod liver oil in the morning. And now, in, you know, 14 years later, we're learning about bioavailability. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Turmeric is good for you, but it's even better if you have it with black pepper.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Okay. What about what do we not know? Right. And the thing is that these things give us pleasure. Well, my goodness, Nikki, if you feel great about your, you know, just eating the 2 tablespoons, okay. But if you mixed it into a smoothie, if you made it into your coffee drink in the morning.
Enough. That's a thing now, coffee.
If you fried an egg for 6 grams of protein and you had a little shallow fry in a cast iron pan for a little bit of iron, you know, think of all the good things you're doing and you're getting that flavor. Those biophenols don't disappear. We have measured that the polyphenol content in the oil diminishes with cooking, but it gets higher in that steak or that egg or those vegetables that you sauteed. So it doesn't last forever. If you keep frying in that oil, the second fry, the third fry, there's less there because it's gone into the food you've already eaten. So I would say, sure. If you want to drink olive oil in the morning, but I think there's a much more pleasant way of having your dose.
Speaking of this pleasure, like my mouth is watering. Can we taste one together? One of your beautiful bottles that you sent me with these very, very special, your own beautiful blue glass tasting glasses. Is it time?
I think so. And you know, with wine, you have Riedel glass, and we don't have a big maker like that, but we have a standard that the International Olive Council in Spain has set. So I had these glasses made to that standard. I'm going to ask us to open the Arbequina first. This oil is beautiful. Something that I think
it's just,
well, thank you.
Just looking at this bottle, like since it arrived last week, I'm caressing it and I'm hugging it. It's gorgeous.
Well, the nice thing about Arbequina is that it really illustrates one of the phases of agriculture in California. This is new technology to be able to make an oil like this. So I'm going to go ahead and pour into my blue glass, which we do because color should matter. If the oil is brown, it's oxidized. But, you know, straw yellow, dark emerald green, it really doesn't matter in terms of whether it's extra virgin. And I'm going to go ahead and do a little pour.
I love, by the way, on these beautiful glasses that people can get on your website, which, of course, we're going to share. It's got the T on the bottom. So that's branded because you had these made. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of professionals around the world use these glasses. And so I make them as neutral as possible. But I do like people to know that they're mouth blown and hand finished right to the spec. So
it's beautiful.
One of the things that we can do, Nikki, I'm going to just hold my oil in my hand. And you'll notice there's a little bit of indentation. It fits right into this part of your hand. So it's really nice.
Yeah.
And we go like this to kind of create a little bit of friction and a little bit of heat.
So you've got the base of the glass in one palm, and then the other hand, you're twisting the glass. Twisting,
and right. So, Nikki, you're right-handed?
Yes.
So you have the glass in your left hand. Now take your right hand and put it over the top so that you're trapping those volatile aromas as you spin around there. And just And we can just do this where we talk a little bit about Arbequina.
Okay.
Arbequina is a Spanish variety. It has been hybridized into a more dwarf form where it will accept being pruned aggressively into a hedge. So in the late 20th century, some Spanish investors came up with this idea that they could use a modified grape harvester, an over-the-row canopy contact harvester, to take fruit off the trees more readily. And in order to do that, they would have to plant the olive trees more close together, and they would have to keep them pruned in the same shape of the inside of the harvester.
Okay.
Which becomes a hedgerow. And I think there's only 8 varieties in the world that will take this kind of heavy pruning. Arbequina is self-fertile, but it is more productive when it has pollinizers like Koroniki and Arbasana. So you'll very frequently see that. And I think in terms of calling something 100% Arbequina or just Arbequina, you have to have at least 90% in the state of California. So many producers have a field blend. So you're buying Arbequina, but it's got a little bit of these other pollinizers in it, which can be very interesting.
It kind of mirrors wine a little bit, I think, in the labeling and the leeway.
The Spanish investors looked around the world, and where was there ample land and water and acceptance of new ideas? And they thought about South America, Australia, and they chose California because it was the same hemisphere.
Got it.
So California Olive Ranch, which is the number 2 brand in the country right now, that was the Spanish investor. By 2010, they had spent $110 million on research and development and building that brand. And the original super high density Arbequina orchards in the world are right off of I-5 in Artois, mm-hmm. and they are still productive. Mm-hmm. So what does this mean in English? What does this mean to you as somebody who likes to cook? It means that, I'll give you an example of the orchard that is behind me here, 2.5 miles. 135,000 trees on 200 acres can be harvested by 3 men in 6 days. If you've ever looked at a tree, even in your backyard plum tree, and think how long it takes you to harvest that one tree,
yeah.
135,000 trees in 6 days with 3 men. That's because you're running the harvester day and night. You just change teams out. And you've got a gondola running next to it, and all the fruit that's coming off of the tree goes right next.
Does it vibrate the trees and then they fall down into the nuts? Is that kind of what I'm envisioning?
Imagine a small house driving over a row of trees that the top of the tree is about 7 feet. So the harvester itself, I think, is 15 feet high. And as it's driving over, there are 6 bow arms that come out and they do vibrate. There's also a tread on the bottom that goes in only one direction. So as they are driving, the tree trunk is kind of hugged, mm-hmm. as the harvester is moving about 3 miles an hour. And as the olives fall, they don't touch the ground. They fall inside the harvester where there's 2 conveyors that go up to the top and then a chute that shoots it out the side to the next row where there is a driver pulling a gondola. And the reason why I say 3 men is that one guy's driving the harvester, one guy's driving the gondola, and they're keeping it full, and then they radio in. If it's getting full, they get the next guy in to go right behind him and fill up the next gondola while he parks it into a bigger unit to take to a mill.
Yeah.
So that's where we're hauling, 20 tons of olives per session in these big mills like California Olive Ranch. And when I had a mill at Lucero, you're milling 5 tons an hour, so 100 tons an hour comes through in big truckloads. And it means that the cost of oil per ounce is so much lower. And because you do it, you go from tree to mill so quickly, you don't have a problem with fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can get it there one way. And
same as wine, same as wine harvest.
Yeah, just timing.
Yeah.
You have because these trees aren't 1,000 years old, they're 20 years old or 10 years old. We're able in California, with the benefit of how the investment was made and the timing, and we had the technology to purpose built the mills to accept the tonnage that was being grown, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who says bad things about old world olives they're being naughty, because there are some mind-blowing, amazing, high-quality oils coming out of these places.
Yeah.
Tunisia, everywhere, just beautiful people, hardworking farmers who make beautiful product. The thing is that if you're in a country with millions of trees and no infrastructure to process those, and the pressure to just make sure you have the metric tons to, it is a commodity then, and it's traded differently. It's traded in 20-ton flexi tanks and not in little splits. Is 375 bottles.
Is it safe to say when consumers in the U.S. see large plastic jugs in big box stores of oil that this is where that's coming from?
Yes, I'd say that that's very likely. You know, they couldn't tell you exactly the orchard or the circumstance. Yeah. You know, those commoditized oils, I always say indeterminate origin and age. Olive oil in those circumstances is traded and put into big tanks. Simple answer is yes. It's not going to be very high quality because you wouldn't put your oil in plastic, number one. You wouldn't have it clear, number two. And the fact is that when you have it in that size, it's about moving big volumes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all about just getting efficient bottling.
Well, and I think when you buy in bulk like that, you know, we've all been trained in these bulk stores in larger quantity that you're paying less per ounce. But when I look in the bottom of your beautiful glass, not clear, Arbequina bottle, it says, consume within 4 weeks of opening, store in a dark, dry, and cool place, but consume within 4 weeks of opening. Most people who buy those big glug, glug, glug jugs, you're not telling me that you're going through that in 4 weeks.
Yeah. You know, again, in matters of taste, there's no dispute. How are they using it? What are their expectations? I've had customers apologize to me. They buy my oil. They subscribe to my oil. Then they say, kind of conspiratorially, you know, I also buy this 2 liters in a pack at Costco. It's such a great price. And they're the Kirkland brand, and they're from Italy, and they're really cringing.
Yep.
It's like, well, I happen to have been in the bottling plant in Italy, in Western Tuscany, when they had their oil on the line, and it was exquisite. And I have to also know that Costco's invested in having their regional buyers and their national buyers go to olive oil school to be able to assess what a defect is. So they have great respect for the farmer. They also just work on single-digit margins and buy great quantities. So yeah, I mean, it's not bad oil.
It's not bad. I mean,
can it go rancid like any other oil? Yeah, but typically, and if you have a big family and you're using a lot of oil, it's a good value.
Yeah,
it's a good value.
Okay, but it's a good value check. Then why should people purchase what you're making?
Because it's a different experience.
Yeah.
You know, you're buying local. It's got a lower carbon footprint. You might get a different complexity or harmony. I have customers who buy both.
Yeah.
And it's because of how they use the oil.
Yeah.
If we hadn't had the crisis of, you know, these drought years and some other things, I would go back to selling larger format again. And I would like to in the future. We're just not there yet as we're coming back. But anyway, I just wanted to really be clear that there are bad commodity and good commodity,
mm-hmm.
maybe.
Yep. It's the same as wine. This is the parallel.
Yeah.
I love. Can I please taste this now?
Yes, and I put mine down, but let's just start off. We always start with aroma.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you, Nikki, does this seem more green or ripe to you? Actually, the first question is this fresh to you? Do you smell any Play-Doh?
No. I smell fresh olives. Yeah. Oh my God, my mouth is watering. What was the question that you asked me? Is it seem green?
Yeah. So when we think about it, after when you taste a while, you can start to detect, if you know an olive's varietal characteristic, how does it express itself when it's green versus ripe? Some of them are fairly close, but some of them are pretty distinctive. Okay. When we taste as olive oil people, we look at three things, and those three things have three descriptors. We look at fruitiness, bitterness, and pungency as three positive attributes, those define extra virgin.
Okay.
And when we say fruitiness, we mean, how does it smell on the nose, right? So you're smelling it. And so we're judging in competition before we even put the oil in our mouth. We're already rating the fruitiness.
Mm.
We're rating it in terms of its intensity, and we're rating it in terms of, is this a medium intensity? I can't smell it at arm's length, but it's pretty nice here, kind of, you know, mid range. So I'd say this is like a 4, maybe.
Smells so good. I want to taste it.
It is. It's really good. And I'm getting mostly green, but some ripe fruit as well.
Yeah.
For me, you know, and which fits with when the period of time it was harvested.
in wine, we talk about if there's a greenness in wine, it's like that pyrazine, veggie, you know, vegetal, like bell pepper note. I think I understand mm-hmm. that's not what we're referring to when we say green in olive oil. Green in this situation just equals a freshness.
It's a positive. Yeah. What I sense here is a little bit of green apple.
Ooh,
and there's a floral.
Yeah.
Okay. And I didn't smell this in November when I completed the tasting notes, but it is very floral to me today.
So this was harvested in November.
But yeah, I'm getting a lot of floral.
Yes. Oh, it smells amazing.
You know, I don't know if it's jasmine flowers or something, right? The second thing is bitterness. That's in the mouth. And that is, but what you would think is there's some astringency to it. And that's a positive attribute. And we look at intensity there as well. And then when we swallow it to the retronasal, you smell much more with everything in the back of the throat. So we do something called strapaggio. We aerate. And then as we swallow, we get the retronasal then. So it is part of it. And that's the bitterness. That's the cough, which I believe was one of the questions.
That was about. Morgan's question. Yeah, Morgan said.
That's right. I saw that. I thought that was a great question.
Yeah, Morgan said, when an olive oil is more spicy or what I would describe as a burn in the throat, which is not mm-hmm. always bad, mm-hmm. what makes some more or less in that way?
We now know.
Is it only adapted?
20 years ago.
Is it
No, it's oleocanthal. Oleocanthal, it's like the miracle phenol of all the phenols. Mm. And I measured the oleocanthal for these oils, particularly of the 25 that were measured, 12% of it was, which is like great. So I'm going to go ahead and taste now and I'm going to do the little.
I need to stop asking you questions so we can taste it, but I have so many.
And Donald brought out my pizza, so I'm right aligned.
Of our margaritas.
So I'm going to go ahead.
Okay. I'm just going to copy you on the screen how you taste it.
What I did, Nikki, is it was already warm from my hand and when we were talking. But when I had it in my mouth, one of the things we learn as tasters is that the chart they told us about in elementary school about where our taste buds were, everybody's mapped differently. And we have taste buds in our cheeks and, you know, all these places. So I hold the oil in my mouth and I let it be there. And then I did this strapaggio where I aerated it.
Strapaggio, Italian for what? We should know this. I should know this.
That slurping sight. I know. And I used to be able to define it literally, but now I just...
We'll go with that.
I think it is. I mean, it's just that thing. And so as you do that, you're drawing it across your buds and back into your throat. And as you breathe, it goes back up into that retronasal.
It didn't make me cough, though. It didn't make me cough.
I've got a little burn. Mm-hmm. It's got a long finish. I still feel it in my throat as we talk. And the green apple is much more present to me now than it was on the nose. Mm-hmm. And I'm also getting some almond. And that's the ripeness.
Almond is a note in olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
Would you put mm-hmm. that in the fruitiness category? Or it's its own?
Yeah, it's all fruity.
That's all.
And any kind of, you know, from grasses to flowers to fruits, they're all considered that.
Amazing. So happy to be here this afternoon doing this with you and having this olive oil in my hand and about to be in my mouth. This is so awesome. Thank you. The suspense. Now you're wondering, how did it taste, Nikki? Was it everything that it was built up to be? Well, you'll just have to tune in next week to your Olive Oil 102 when Liz and I continue our awesome conversation. I mean, how fascinating. If you would like to purchase her beautiful oils from her website, the Arbequina and Ascolano are the two that we discussed. She sells the beautiful blue tasting glasses. She even sells olive wood mortar and pestle and serving boards. You can even buy olive trees, small trees to gift to people. What an awesome gift. So check out AmericanOliveFarmer.com and you can use the discount code Nikki $10, so NIKKI, the $ and the number 10, for $10 off your order. Thank you so much for that, Liz, and thank you for spending time with our listeners. And as always, if you'd like to try the beautiful Solovato Sangiovese that I made and that paired so beautifully and that Liz was so complimentary of, link in the show notes for solovatowines.com, and you can use Pod Listener for 10% off your order.
We're giving discounts on olive oil. We're giving discounts on wine. I mean, come on. Does it get better than this? And if you have someone in your life who you think would enjoy this information as much as you did, please share this episode from most podcast platforms. There's a little arrow where you can literally send it as a text message or an email to someone. And let's spread the love. Thank you so much for listening. And again, tune in next week for the conclusion. And as always, sip well.